The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, Shavuot Tov, how are you?
Boker Tov, Shavuot Tov. Yes, it's been a very, very busy and somewhat tragic weekend. But before we even talk about the events of Yom HaTzmaut and what's been happening since then, you may recall the recent death of Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, who was the de facto head of, in Israel at least, of the Lithuanian branch of ultra-Orthodox Judaism. He died last month. His funeral was one of the biggest in Israel, with tens of thousands of people attending. And now a huge dispute has broken out over his inheritance. And we understand that the source of the dispute comes from the fact that an ultra-Orthodox U.S. businessman, Louis Shiner, has offered to buy Rav Kanievsky's original writings for an amount of $7 million, which suddenly increases the estate that the late rabbi has left behind quite substantially. The problem is that the negotiations over these writings and the acquisition of these writings by Louis Shiner has been conducted with one of the late rabbi's sons, Shaul Kanievsky. He is the one who actually is living in the home of his late father and is one of three sons that the late rabbi left behind. Shaul apparently conducted these negotiations discreetly with Louis Shiner over the past few weeks without the knowledge of his other brothers or siblings. He has two other brothers, older brothers, and he also has five sisters. And apparently none of them were aware of these discussions and of these negotiations. And then it turns out that Shaul Kanievsky believes that his late father wanted him to be the sole heir of the rabbi's inheritance. And of course, this has not gone down well with his other siblings, and particularly with his two older brothers, who said that their father always wanted the inheritance to be conducted according to Torah law. Mm. And interestingly, Torah law says that the inheritance is divided equally amongst the sons. So actually the daughters don't even have any show in any of this, and it's all about the sons, and the sons claim that they should be entitled to at least their own one third of the inheritance. This has now apparently been taken to a mediation by another U.S. businessman who has Reuben Schron. He's a real estate tycoon and philanthropist, and he was apparently a close confidant of Rav Kanievsky, and he's been called upon to mediate this particular issue. But clearly the brothers are not seeing eye to eye. And it's not only that the brothers are not seeing eye to eye, but it also involves grandchildren as well, because some of the grandchildren were involved in helping the late rabbi while he was alive, their grandfather. And so this has really pitted the Kanievsky family one against each other only a month or so after they buried their father. So it's a very tragic situation.
The best way to ruin a legacy. Absolutely ruin all the good, or a lot of the good that's been done. That's really, really terrible. A sad story indeed. I just hope it does get resolved. Another terrible story, of course, have been the terror attacks that have taken place. So there was one on Yom HaTzmaut in Elad. What is the latest there in terms of the terrorists?
So just to remind us to what happened on the day of Yom HaTzmaut, this terror attack took place late in the afternoon. I'd spoken to you in the morning, and we were celebrating all the good things about Yom HaTzmaut without having an inkling of what might be lying ahead of us during the course of the day, particularly in El Ad, where that very, very tragic attack took place. And very, very strange things. People were out in Elad. There were families at the amphitheater enjoying Yom HaTzmaut, as people do. It's usually a time when people like to go out and to barbecue and to be outdoors and to be with friends. And that's exactly what was happening in Elad. And then the story broke of a terror attack that had taken place with two terrorists who had attacked people who were just out in the street, and three fathers ultimately were victims of this attack. Three of them were killed. The fathers between them have left 16 children without fathers. as a result of this terror attack. Three young men leaving 16 children without fathers because of the terror attack. And then transpired that the terrorists seemed to be at least known to one of the people, because one of the men who was killed is reported to have transported them to El Ad from somewhere else, drove them to the place of the terror attack. It seems he might have known them. It transpires that they probably had been working in the area of El Ad illegally, and so people knew these guys. They turned up in El Ad with axes and with weapons, and they simply used their axes and their weapons to chop and to shoot at people and to kill these three young men, and to injure quite a number of other people around them as well. Heroic stories about how these men fought off these terrorists in order to protect their children, that the children were sent home, that the children were sent fleeing in order to protect their lives successfully, fortunately, in this particular case. But unfortunately, they paid for their heroism by giving up their own lives in the process and leaving very, very devastated community and families behind them. The two terrorists then disappeared from the scene. By the time the security forces came around to see what was going on, these two guys had disappeared. And then ensued a 60-hour search over Shabbat for these terrorists who just disappeared into the local area around El Ad, and the security forces were quite sure that they were still in the local vicinity, even though, of course, there was a possibility that they'd escaped further away. But they seemed to be quite sure that they were in the local vicinity. Some 800 IDF troops took part in the manhunt in order to track these guys down. Finally, yesterday, it was announced that two suspects had been detained, a 19-year-old and a 20-year-old, both of them coming from Rumama, which is an Arab town near to Jenin. They were found in a forested area close to El Ad. There were apparently some little pieces of evidence that had been picked up during the course of Shabbat, a piece of pita bread apparently. There were some banknotes that were found that had some blood stains on it. Finally, the two suspects were found hiding under some sort of a lump of grass in order to try and fit in with the local flora in that area, with a forest area, to try and conceal themselves. But they were ultimately detained by the IDF. They were a little surprised when they were detained, but they were found without food or water. And so ultimately, they were going to be flushed out no matter what happened. And good job to our security services for being determined in finding these guys in the forest. Interestingly, we are told that the bloodstained banknotes were taken on Shabbat and were already DNA tested before the two suspects were detained. So by the time they were detained, the security forces knew exactly who the individuals were that they were searching for through the DNA tests that had been done. Unfortunately, that wasn't the end of the story, because yesterday we then also suffered a number of terror attacks where fortunately no injuries were sustained and no lives were lost. But there was a border policeman. Well, when I say no injuries, unfortunately, it was very light injury. This border policeman was stabbed at the Damascus Gate and very, very lightly injured. Fortunately, colleagues around managed to shoot the assailant, a Palestinian. There was also an attack that took place in the Tekoa settlement where a resident of the community killed a Palestinian man who was armed with a knife, who came to the doorway of his home. And when he saw what was happening, he literally just shot him on the spot. He was found to have had a knife afterwards and was clearly a threat to the community in Tekoa. So that was something very, very quick reaction. Seemed to save the lives of many people. There was a search conducted to try to make sure that there were no other people involved in this particular case, and there didn't seem to be anybody else involved, and so the security situation there has been lifted. But also earlier in the day, IDF troops shot at a Palestinian man who tried to cross a West Bank security barrier into Israel near to Tulkarem, and the troops shot at the man in accordance with standard procedures for dealing with suspicious people. So clearly things are very much on edge at the moment. Wherever you go, people are just very nervous about slightly strange conduct, slightly strange behavior, because of the fact that we know that the particularly the Gaza leadership have called upon Palestinians across Gaza and across the West Bank, across Judea and Samaria, the Palestinian Authority area, wherever they happen to be, to take axes and to literally go and kill Jewish people. This has been the call by the Gaza leadership for the Palestinian people to take up arms and to go out and kill people, which of course has created a lot of controversy around how the Israeli government should potentially respond to that call. There have been calls to even to carry out selective assassinations against some of those Gaza leaders, in particular Sinwar, who is the leader of Gaza, and also Mohammed Diouf, who is one of the security leaders within the Gaza Strip. There have been calls to potentially carry out assassination attacks against those. The IDF, I understand, are saying that that's not the best idea right now, and they're speaking out against the possibility of carrying out those attacks. But certainly there is a lot of thought at the moment as to how Israel should be responding to the current security situation.
Is there frustration in Israel around this? Because there's definitely the number of attacks, the number of successful, in inverted commas, attacks have definitely increased over the last couple of months. What is the Israeli public saying to government about it?
I think that following the end of Ramadan, there was a feeling that things may well just dissipate, because as you picked up during the time that you were here, there was definitely an upsurge in security issues, in attacks that were carried out, in people that were killed during the period of Ramadan. And there was a hope, perhaps even a suspicion, that things may well just dissipate. But unfortunately, with the Yom HaTzmaut attack, and now with three attacks that were carried out yesterday, the feeling is perhaps not that it won't dissipate following the end of Ramadan. The Israeli public is not expressing frustration in any great numbers at the moment. There are, of course, particularly right-wing politicians who have come out and been critical of the government, criticized the way that they handled the security situation in general, criticized Prime Minister Naftali Bennett about being too focused on the war in Russia, the war in Ukraine, and not sufficiently focused on what's happening in Israel. Some frustration being expressed by individuals during the period of Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaTzmaut, when the Prime Minister attended a number of public events, and there were incidents of people calling him out and really screaming at him over some of his conduct, conduct in recent months. I don't think that there is a public uprising at the moment in frustration against these attacks, but it won't take much for that to start to happen, if indeed there isn't a noticeable action that's taking, noticeable improvement in the situation, and action being taken, a very, very visible action being taken by the Israeli government in order to deal with this.
It's certainly not a great situation at all. The U.S. administration has requested the Israeli government to refrain from authorizing any further construction in the settlements ahead of the visit by President Biden. How has the Israeli government reacted to this request?
So this has been a very, very strange request. And, you know, it's come in the form of a notification to the Israeli government saying that the Biden administration will view very gravely any construction or any decisions to carry out construction which are taken ahead of the proposed visit that's due to take place by President Biden, I think probably sometime next month. We don't have a fixed date as yet, but it looks as if though it's likely to happen during the course of June sometime. Of course, the Israeli government is not minded to comply with this particular request, order, call it whatever you want, for the simple reason that Naftali Bennett is really trying to manage some sort of a mutiny within his coalition at the moment, as we saw before Pesach, He was reduced down to only 60 seats in his coalition, which means that he really is unable to pass things through the Knesset that need a full majority of the Knesset. Anything that requires 61 seats and more, 61 votes and more, he theoretically at the moment is not in a position to bring through the Knesset. And in addition to that, the Arab Ram Party also froze their participation in the coalition. So Naftali Bennett is really managing a very difficult situation and a potentially life-threatening situation to his coalition government, because if it happens that a vote of no confidence is brought and he is unable to muster up the required 61 votes in order to oppose the vote of no confidence, that government might be out on the street, and we may well be back into an election situation. Mm. So Naftali Bennett is currently trying to pander in some way to the right-wing part of his coalition government. And of course, the right-wing part of the coalition are the ones who are really asking him, demanding of him, that he approve construction in the settlements. Initially, he had advanced plans for quite a large number of new homes in the settlements, and these are all homes being built within existing boundaries. In other words, it's not about taking a currently uninhabited piece of land and creating an inhabitation out of that piece of land. This is all about constructing more within existing boundaries. There was quite a large plan that had been put forward that has now been reduced down to 3,988 homes, apparently in order to appease the United States, but I think more importantly, to somehow appease members of his coalition, particularly those on the right wing, to say, in spite of the fact that the US government has demanded that we don't approve any construction, we are doing so because we are going our own way. And this should hopefully help to appease members of the right wing of his coalition. We will see how all of that goes down. Obviously, the US government is not well pleased with that particular decision. But I suspect that the visit of Joe Biden will go ahead no matter what, in spite of this. He might not be as happy as he would have been otherwise. But of course, our prime minister has got a very, very tough set of circumstances in order to manage for himself right now.
Absolutely. And I suspect Joe Biden might not remember it anyway. It is 8 o'clock. I'm Harmut Feldman. Anthony Reich, thank you. As always, we'll catch you tomorrow morning at 7:45.